Chapter 8. He woke, after a disturbed and dreamful sleep, in full daylight. He had a dry mouth, a crick in his neck, and a soreness in his limbs. It was so unlike all previous wakings in the world of Venus that for a moment he supposed himself back on Earth. And the dream, for so it seemed to him, of having lived and walked on the oceans of the morning star, rushed through his memory with a sense of lost sweetness that was well-nigh unbearable. Then he sat up, and the facts came back to him. "It's jolly nearly the same as having waked from a dream, though," he thought. Hunger and thirst became at once his dominant sensations, but he conceived it a duty to look first at the sick man, though with very little hope that he could help him. He gazed round. There was the grove of silvery trees, all right, but he could not see Weston. Then he glanced at the bay. There was no punt, either. Assuming that in the darkness he had blundered into the wrong valley, he rose and approached the stream for a drink. As he lifted his face from the water with a long sigh of satisfaction, his eyes suddenly fell on a little wooden box, and then beyond it on a couple of tins. His brain was working rather slowly, and it took him a few seconds to realize that he was in the right valley after all, and a few more to draw conclusions from the fact that the box was open and empty, and that some of the stores had been removed and others left behind. But was it possible that a man in Weston's physical condition could have recovered sufficiently during the night to strike camp and to go away laden with some kind of pack? Was it possible that any man could have faced a sea like that in a collapsible punt? It was true, as he now noticed for the first time, that the storm, which had been a mere squall by Perelandrian standards, appeared to have blown itself out during the night. But there was still a quite formidable swell, and it seemed out of the question that the professor could have left the island. Much more probably he had left the valley on foot and carried the punt with him. Ransom decided that he must find Weston at once. He must keep in touch with his enemy. For if Weston had recovered, there was no doubt he meant mischief of some kind. Ransom was not at all certain that he had understood all his wild talk on the previous day, but what he did understand he disliked very much, and suspected that this vague mysticism about spirituality would turn out to be something even nastier than his old and comparatively simple program of planetary imperialism. It would be unfair to take seriously the things the man had said immediately before his seizure, no doubt, but there was enough without that. The next few hours Ransom passed in searching the island for food and for Weston. As far as food was concerned, he was rewarded. Some fruit like bilberries could be gathered in handfuls on the upper slopes, and the wooded valleys abounded in a kind of oval nut. The kernel had a toughly soft consistency, rather like cork or kidneys, and the flavour, though somewhat austere and prosaic after the fruit of the floating islands, was not unsatisfactory. The giant mice were as tame as other Perelandrian beasts, but seemed stupider. Ransom ascended to the central plateau. The sea was dotted with islands in every direction, rising and falling with the swell, and all separated from one another by wide stretches of water. His eye at once picked out an orange-coloured island, but he did not know whether it was that on which he had been living, for he saw at least two others in which the same colour predominated. At one time he counted 23 floating islands in all. That, he thought, was more than the temporary archipelago had contained, and allowed him to hope that any one of those he saw might hide the king, or that the king might even at this moment be reunited to the lady. Without thinking it out very clearly, he had come to rest almost all his hopes on the king. Of Weston he could find no trace. It really did seem, in spite of all improbabilities, that he had somehow contrived to leave the fixed island. And Ransom's anxiety was very great. What Weston, in his new vein, might do, he had no idea. The best to hope for was that he would simply ignore the master and mistress of Perelandra as mere savages or natives. Late in the day, being tired, he sat down on the shore. There was very little swell now, and the waves, just before they broke, were less than knee-deep. His feet, made soft by the mattress-like surface which one walks on in those floating islands, were hot and sore. Presently he decided to refresh them by a little wading. The delicious quality of the water drew him out till he was waist-deep. As he stood there, deep in thought, he suddenly perceived that what he had taken to be an effect of light on the water was really the back of one of the great silvery fish. "I wonder would it let me ride it," he thought. And then, watching how the beast nosed towards him and kept itself as near the shallows as it dared, it was borne in upon him that it was trying to attract his attention. Could it have been sent? The thought had no sooner darted through his mind than he decided to make the experiment. He laid his hand across the creature's back, and it did not flinch from his touch. Then, with some difficulty, he scrambled into a sitting position across the narrow part behind its head, and while he was doing this, it remained as nearly stationary as it could. But as soon as he was firmly in the saddle, it whisked itself about and headed for the sea. If he had wished to withdraw, it was very soon impossible to do so. Already the green pinnacles of the mountain, as he looked back, had withdrawn their summits from the sky, and the coastline of the island had begun to conceal its bays and nesses. The breakers were no longer audible, only the prolonged sibilant or chattering noises of the water about him. Many floating islands were visible, though seen from this level they were mere feathery silhouettes. But the fish seemed to be heading for none of these. Straight on, as if it well knew its way, the beat of the great fins carried him for more than an hour. Then green and purple splashed the whole world, and after that, darkness. Somehow he felt hardly any uneasiness when he found himself swiftly climbing and descending the low hills of water through the black night. And here it was not all black. The heavens had vanished, and the surface of the sea, but far, far below him, in the heart of the vacancy through which he appeared to be travelling, strange bursting star-shells and writhing streaks of a bluish-green luminosity appeared. At first they were very remote, but soon, as far as he could judge, they were nearer. A whole world of phosphorescent creatures seemed to be at play not far from the surface, coiling eels and darting things in complete armour. And then heraldically fantastic shapes to which the seahorse of our own waters would be commonplace. They were all round him, 20 or 30 of them often in sight at once. And mixed with all this riot of sea centaurs and sea dragons, he saw yet stranger forms. Fishes, if fishes they were, whose forward part was so nearly human in shape that when he first caught sight of them, he thought he had fallen into a dream and shook himself to awake. But it was no dream. There, and there again. It was unmistakable. Now a shoulder, now a profile, and then for one second a full face. Veritable mermen or mermaids. The resemblance to humanity was indeed greater, not less, than he had first supposed. What had for a moment concealed it from him was the total absence of human expression. Yet the faces were not idiotic. They were not even brutal parodies of humanity like those of our terrestrial apes. They were more like human faces asleep, or faces in which humanity slept while some other life, neither bestial nor diabolic, but merely elvish, out of our orbit, was irrelevantly awake. He remembered his old suspicion that what was myth in one world might always be fact in some other. He wondered also whether the king and queen of Perelandra, though doubtless the first human pair of this planet, might on the physical side have a marine ancestry. And if so, what then of the man-like things before men in our own world? Must they in truth have been the wistful brutalities whose pictures we see in popular books on evolution? Or were the old myths truer than the modern myths? Had there in truth been a time when satyrs danced in the Italian woods? But he said hush to his mind at this stage, for the mere pleasure of breathing in the fragrance which now began to steal towards him from the blackness ahead. Warm and sweet, and every moment sweeter and purer, and every moment stronger and more filled with all delights, it came to him. He knew well what it was. He would know it henceforward out of the whole universe, the night breath of a floating island in the star Venus. It was strange to be filled with homesickness for places where his sojourn had been so brief, and which were, by any objective standard, so alien to all our race. Or were they? The cord of longing which drew him to the invisible isle seemed to him at that moment to have been fastened long, long before his coming to Perelandra, long before the earliest times that memory could recover in his childhood, before his birth, before the birth of man himself, before the origins of time. It was sharp, sweet, wild, and holy, all in one, and in any world where men's nerves have ceased to obey their central desires would doubtless have been aphrodisiac too. But not in Perelandra. The fish was no longer moving. Ransom put out his hand. He found he was touching weed. He crawled forward over the head of the monstrous fish and levered himself onto the gently moving surface of the island. Short as his absence from such places had been, his earth-trained habits of walking had reasserted themselves, and he fell more than once as he groped his way on the heaving lawn. But it did no harm falling here. Good luck to it. There were trees all about him in the dark, and when a smooth, cool, rounded object came away in his hand, he put it, unfearing, to his lips. It was none of the fruits he had tasted before. It was better than any of them. Well might the lady say of her world that the fruit you ate at any moment was, at that moment, the best. Wearied with his day's walking and climbing, and still more, borne down by absolute satisfaction, he sank into dreamless sleep. He felt that it was several hours later when he awoke and found himself still in darkness. He knew, too, that he had been suddenly waked. And a moment later he was listening to the sound that had waked him. It was the sound of voices, a man's voice and a woman's in earnest conversation. He judged that they were very close to him, for in a Perelandrian night an object is no more visible 6 inches than 6 miles away. He perceived at once who the speakers were, but the voices sounded strange, and the emotions of the speakers were obscure to him, with no facial expression to eke them out. "I am wondering," said the woman's voice, "whether all the people of your world have the habit of talking about the same thing more than once. I have said already that we are forbidden to dwell on the fixed land. Why do you not either talk of something else or stop talking?"
"Because this forbidding is such a strange one," said the man's voice, "and so unlike the ways of Maleldil in my world. And he has not forbidden you to think about dwelling on the fixed land."
"Well, that would be a strange thing, to think about what will never happen."
"Nay, in our world we do it all the time. We put words together to mean things that have never happened and places that never were, beautiful words, well put together, and then tell them to one another. We call it stories or poetry. In that old world you spoke of, Malakandra, they did the same. It is for mirth and wonder and wisdom."
"What is the wisdom in it?"
"Because the world is made up not only of what is, but of what might be. Maleldil knows both and wants us to know both."
"Well, this is more than I ever thought of. The other, the piebald one, has already told me things which made me feel like a tree whose branches were growing wider and wider apart. But this goes beyond all. Stepping out of what is into what might be, and talking and making things out there, alongside the world. I will ask the king what he thinks of it."
"You see, that is what we always come back to. If only you had not been parted from the king."
"Oh, I see. That also is one of the things that might be. The world might be so made that the king and I were never parted."
"The world would not have to be different, only the way you live. In a world where people live on the fixed lands, they do not become suddenly separated."
"But you remember, we are not to live on the fixed land."
"No, but he has never forbidden you to think about it. Might not that be one of the reasons why you are forbidden to do it? So that you may have a might-be to think about, to make a story about, as we call it?"
"I will think more of this. I will get the king to make me older about it."
"How greatly I desire to meet this king of yours. But in the matter of stories he may be no older than you himself."
"That saying of yours is like a tree with no fruit. The king is always older than I, and about all things."
"But Piebald and I have already made you older about certain matters which the king never mentioned to you. That is the new good which you never expected. You thought you would always learn all things from the king, but now Maleldil has sent you other men whom it never entered your mind to think of, and they have told you things the king himself could not know."
"I begin to see now why the king and I were parted at this time. This is a strange and great good he intended for me."
"And if you refused to learn things from me, and kept on saying you would wait and ask the king, would that not be like turning away from the fruit you had found to the fruit you had expected?"
"These are deep questions, stranger. Maleldil is not putting much into my mind about them."
"Or do you not see why?"
"No."
"Since Piebald and I have come to your world, we have put many things into your mind which Maleldil has not. Do you not see that he is letting go of your hand a little?"
"How could he? He is wherever we go."
"Yes, but in another way. He is making you older, making you to learn things not straight from him, but by your own meetings with other people and your own questions and thoughts.
He is certainly doing that.
Yes. He is making you a full woman, for up till now you are only half-made, like the beasts who do nothing of themselves. This time, when you meet the king again, it is you who will have things to tell him. It is you who will be older than he, and who will make him older.
Well, Maleldil would not make a thing like that happen. It would be like a fruit with no taste.
But it would have a taste for him. Do you not think the king must sometimes be tired of being the older? Would he not love you more if you were wiser than he?
Is this what you call a poetry, or do you mean that it really is?
I mean a thing that really is.
But how could anyone love anything more? It is like saying a thing could be bigger than itself.
I only meant you could become more like the women of my world.
What are they like?
They are of a great spirit. They always reach out their hands for the new and unexpected good, and see that it is good long before the men understand it. Their minds run ahead of what Maleldil has told them. They do not need to wait for him to tell them what is good, but know it for themselves, as he does. They are, as it were, little Maleldils. And because of their wisdom, their beauty is as much greater than yours as the sweetness of these gourds surpasses the taste of water. And because of their beauty, the love which the men have for them is as much greater than the king's love for you, as the naked burning of deep heaven seen from my world is more wonderful than the golden roof of yours.
I wish I could see them.
I wish you could.
How beautiful is Maleldil, and how wonderful are all his works. Perhaps he will bring out of me daughters as much greater than I, as I am greater than the beasts. It will be better than I thought. I had thought I was to be always queen and lady, but I see now that I may be as the Eldila. I may be appointed to cherish when they are small and weak children who will grow up and overtop me, and at whose feet I shall fall. I see it is not only questions and thoughts that grow out wider and wider like branches. Joy also widens out and comes where we had never thought.
"I will sleep now," said the other voice. As it said this, it became, for the first time, unmistakably the voice of Weston, and of Weston disgruntled and snappish. Up till now, Ransom, though constantly resolving to join the conversation, had been kept silent in a kind of suspense between two conflicting states of mind. On the one hand, he was certain, both from the voice and from many of the things it said, that the male speaker was Weston. On the other hand, the voice, divided from the man's appearance, sounded curiously unlike itself. Still more, the patient, persistent manner in which it was used was very unlike the professor's usual alternation between pompous lecturing and abrupt bullying. And how could a man fresh from such a physical crisis as he had seen Weston undergo have recovered such mastery of himself in a few hours? And how could he have reached the floating island? Ransom had found himself throughout their dialogue confronted with an intolerable contradiction. Something which was and was not Weston was talking, and the sense of this monstrosity, only a few feet away in the darkness, had sent thrills of exquisite horror tingling along his spine, and raised questions in his mind which he tried to dismiss as fantastic. Now that the conversation was over, he realized, too, with what intense anxiety he had followed it. At the same moment, he was conscious of a sense of triumph. But it was not he who was triumphant. The whole darkness about him rang with victory. He started and half raised himself. Had there been any actual sound? Listening hard, he could hear nothing but the low, murmurous noise of warm wind and gentle swell. The suggestion of music must have been from within. But as soon as he lay down again, he felt assured that it was not. From without, most certainly from without, but not by the sense of hearing, festal revelry and dance and splendour poured into him. No sound, yet in such fashion that it could not be remembered or thought of except as music. It was like having a new sense. It was like being present when the morning stars sang together. It was as if Perelandra had that moment been created. And perhaps in some sense it had. The feeling of a great disaster averted was forced upon his mind, and with it came the hope that there would be no second attempt. And then, sweeter than all, the suggestion that he had been brought there not to do anything, but only as a spectator or a witness. A few minutes later, he was asleep.